Hello and welcome to episode number 26 of the Mostly Erlang podcast. Today we are joined by Yehuda from Ben Gurion University, and we're going to be talking about Erlang being taught in a university setting in various contexts. So Yehuda, would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, I'm a lecturer at the Department of Communication Systems Engineering. I've been there since 1998.
Should probably say which university?
Ben Gurion University Be'er Sheva, Israel.
And I should point out, this is a first for our podcast. For the first 25 episodes, this is the first time we've actually had all the participants, although there are only two of us, in the same country. That's never happened before. We usually are numbering about four. All right, go on.
Okay, so. Okay, several years ago, I'm in the Faculty of Engineering. So as part of the curricula, students need to do engineering project in the senior year. And since I'm involved with lots of simulation on communication protocols, I found out that they know almost nothing about state machines. Yeah. I think he's protesting.
All right, go on.
Yeah, and so it happens that each student that was coming to me to do a project under my guidance, they had to learn about finite state machines, or FSM in short. So after several years, I got tired of educating in person and decided that I need to have a course on a finite state machine, but it's not enough for a full course. So in between, I discovered the theory of concurrency, CSP and stuff related to this. And after several years, I decided that I want them to program concurrent programs. So I discovered Erlang. At the time, I found that were Erlang, and the closure was only in initial stages, and I decided to learn Erlang for myself and then teach it in the university. It was an amazing experience.
So these are not computer science students, they're engineering students, right?
No, they're engineering students, yes.
Has there been any crossover into the computer science department with this?
Computer science, about 3 years ago, actually when I started to teach Erlang, I discovered that they start a new course called something like distributed computing or distributed programming that should teach Erlang for about one third of the course and Hadoop for two thirds. And it happens that their experience for the first year was 100% Hadoop, and they didn't teach Erlang at all because they didn't have time. So I'm the only one.
Okay.
Yeah.
And these are undergrads or grad students, or did I already ask that?
Undergraduates.
Undergraduates.
Sorry. Yes. Actually, I do not do research with Erlang yet, but it's on the way.
What type of research are you planning on doing?
What we are planning to do is like cloud computing, but to use Erlang instead of other approaches like C++ or other systems like Hadoop or
Right.
Jira.
Yeah. Certainly been a lot of work done in that space by people, both academia and in industry. The Basho guys and Erlang Solutions, and then some of the folks in the Release project in Europe.
Yes, we are concerned in engineering, at least in communication, to do lots of graph processing.
Okay.
So it goes hand by hand with all the social network analysis. You have huge amount of data. It's like data science, but especially on graphs.
Right. I mean, and Erlang was sort of built to do communications in the first place.
You know, yes.
It started when Joe Armstrong and Robert Verding were trying to program a phone switch, so it kind of is an obvious fit.
Yeah.
So what do you do your research on?
I research on mainly on wireless communications at the lower levels, data link, MAC, a little bit resource allocation, mostly for 4G systems.
Okay.
Like LTE, WiMAX, this my main subject is this.
Okay, I will admit I have not spent much time paying attention recently to that. I'm actually originally a web guy. I started out doing Perl and PHP and JavaScript and other things sort of along the way, and then sort of stumbled into Erlang a couple of years ago when I was trying to escape PHP.
Yeah, it's a good choice.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's based around the fact that the telecom guys solved the problems 20 years ago that the web guy, us web guys, are solving today.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
correctly, and they did it. They did it for good. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I mean, much of the issues. I mean, Unix, of course, Unix itself comes out of telecom as well. You know.
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Kevin, you know, yes. Bell Labs and you know.
Yes. Yes, Bell Labs, AT&T Labs. Yes.
So what are your students using Erlang for? Is it just a basic programming course, or are they actually?
Actually, I decided to teach the course, let's say, in non-academic fashion, more like industry-oriented fashion. So, what we do, we mainly pass the syntax for about 9 lectures. We go from sequential Erlang to concurrent Erlang, and then I expand the knowledge in distributed computing. Like we do something like Hadoop, MapReduce. We do something. And we go beyond and do some a little bit graph processing, but they have to write everything on their own.
All right.
And then let's say the top of the course, they have to do a course project. It takes them about 2 weeks of work. What happens that in 2 weeks of work, they finish projects that can say about 2/3 of a graduation engineering project. It should take 1 year.
Right.
Just writing with Erlang. So I divided them to pairs, to students each group, and they do a lot of issues, from simulation to MapReduce to distributed computing. We purchased a set of BeagleBoards, and they use the BeagleBoards like the platform.
Mm-hmm.
So they have lots of, let's say, computers, and they actually do distributed computing because I already bought some switches, and everybody has its own network to work on, its own LAN.
Sounds like a fun class. I took a class when I was in university in the States.
Yeah, it's real fun.
I took a class on in the physics department on electronics design. I took a couple, but I took one on basically worked out to be building systems to intake data from, you know, so you have an experiment that does some physics. And
you
then need to take that data and shove it, get it into a computer somehow so you can figure out what it all means. So we took a course, started with a PIC microcontroller and built cool stuff around it. This was Brandeis University in the States, the physics department. A lot of fun.
Yeah.
So your students, have they had prior programming experience or?
Yes, our students, actually, they start with Java, unfortunately. And,
have you read Joel Splotsky's article, The Peril of Java Schools?
No.
You should probably read that. I'll put a link in.
I must admit that I don't know OO, object-oriented. I decided not to learn it. I used a little bit C++ at the time. But our students, they learned Java as a first course. Then they learned a combined course of C and C++. And they know assembly, and after that, part of them, only small part, know Erlang.
Yeah, when I started my computer, I started as a computer science major and then switched to physics. So we started with Scheme back in the day.
Yes, very good. Yeah.
And I'm assuming at least some of your students before they, I'm assuming most of them have been through the Army. So presumably some of them have been in various units where they may have been exposed to programming. Having a good friend who... she was in one of the programming units of the Israeli Army and then went to Ben Gurion University. And, you know, now she's out in industry and expecting her first kid. So,
yeah.
I believe her husband also went to Ben Gurion. They both have degrees from there. So, you know, fine tradition of meeting your spouse at university. My parents did it. I've never actually been on the Ben Gurion University campus. I should probably do something. I should probably next time you teach this class, give me an invite. I'll come down and say hi sometime.
Yeah, I'd like to.
I happily give as long as you don't mind me giving it in English because my Hebrew is terrible. But I'd happily give a guest lecture on the web using Erlang on the web or testing or something.
Fantastic. We start in Mars and we get to the advanced stuff. Towards June, so I'll be in contact with you.
You know where I am. I only live in. I'm only in REL. It's not that far.
Yeah,
it's a nice.
Yeah.
It's a nice train ride.
Actually, we took 6 students that had this course he guided the engineering project.
That would be Zvi Abraham, by the way, for people listening who.
Yeah.
Who's another prominent Erlang person here in Israel. I'm trying to avoid some of the Israeli jargon
Yeah.
Names of specific army units and stuff that for us people who've been in Israel for a while, who are Israelis, we know what it means, but those of you outside of Israel are going to sort of be sure, unless you read The Startup Nation, which, by the way, is a good book. But if I said to an Israeli, you know, if you say to an Israeli, oh, so-and-so served in Talpiot or 8200, and they just had an IPO that earned them $30 million, every Israeli goes, oh, that makes sense. Whereas those of you in the who aren't familiar with Israel would be like, huh? Okay. Why not? So just thought I'd share, explain that. It's a little local context here that a lot of high-tech firms in the United States, and for that matter, in Israel and for that matter, in the United States, start with people who've just graduated, who've just come out of the Israeli army and, you know, learn interesting skills in the army, go to university, hone them a little sometimes, and then, you know, 5 minutes later, they're worth $50 million.
Yeah, a startup nation.
Yeah, it's true. You can't swing a cat in Tel Aviv without hitting three startups. Or, you go to a meetup in Tel Aviv, and there's always somebody telling you about their new startup. You know, oh, yeah. Or, you know, the standard, oh, did you hear so-and-so just exited? And it's a little crazy. It's probably about the densest concentration of startups anywhere out of Silicon Valley, and maybe even denser.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm actually working on an idea. Oh, well, it's not really a startup type idea myself. It's more of a SaaS thing. I'm not doing the VC thing in the near future or ever, if I can help it. What type of projects are you guys working on? Do you have your students working on?
Oh, I can. It's a long list of projects.
Well, why don't you show off one of the exciting ones?
I don't have sample on this computer, so I'm at home now.
Well, just tell us about it. You can email me if you have a link. You can email me later. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, actually, this year I took films. Just filmed the presentation of the projects. It's not edited yet, but I can say I will put it on the web and send a link.
Well, I assume they'll be in Hebrew, though.
Yes, unfortunately.
Yeah, this is the problem.
Yeah, but let's say projects that you have to remember, they are not senior. It's like third year out of four.
Right.
And it's only the first course in Erlang, and what they do, let's say, load balancing on the databases.
Okay.
They write the database and write the load balancing algorithm, work on computers. Let's say, unrouting simulation of, let's say, missile attack on Israel. It was popular at the time.
Yeah, so, I can imagine why you guys would care about that deeply.
This actually was the idea of the students. I didn't invent this idea. And actually, I wanted them to simulate or, let's say, generate software with lots of processes. So everything was a process. A missile was a process. A radar was a process. A counter-missile was a process. The settlements were processes. Gaza Strip was a process. So everything was a process.
Yeah, I am. The iron, well, you know, sort of an Iron Dome type system, although the Iron Dome is, I believe, first written in C#, I believe. Yeah, well, a missile got fired at Ashkelon the other day, although I think it landed in an empty field, so nothing happened. But yeah, I will admit I've never actually, I live in Ariel. They don't shoot at us. If Hamas had something that could reach Ariel, they'd shoot it at Tel Aviv, whereas you guys have not been that lucky.
Yeah.
Beersheba has, for those of you outside of Israel, about a year and a half ago in the last round of war, was that a year ago? Whenever that was, Beersheba got many missiles fired at it, and I'm sure it was a less than fun time to be
there. It was 2 years ago.
It was two years ago now? Wow.
Yeah, it was in December. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And most of them got shot down before, thankfully. So that's an area that people around in Israel are kind of concerned about because we see a need.
Yeah.
Nothing like getting shot at to focus your attention. But yeah, we have this system here, the Iron Dome, which is basically, it's a radar anti-missile system that, you know, when Hamas fires a rocket at an Israeli city, these are short-range missiles. They sometimes have a flight time of 15 or 20 seconds. The system basically can pick it up on radar, track it, figure out if it's got a reasonable chance of hitting a city, yeah, or if it's just going to hit an empty field or into the ocean. And if it's going to hit a city, shoot it down with about 90%. I think it's about a 90% accuracy, of efficacy. So saves a lot of lives.
Yeah, for sure.
And, saved us from having to go to war last time, which is getting good all around. It's pretty amazing.
Last year, one nice project was two students actually programmed a network game.
Okay.
You could enter to the game with your own keyboard and computer, and everything was by communication displayed on a single screen, another computer. It was like spacecraft, you know, lots of asteroids and spaceships, and you have to bomb everything. Like an old game.
Oh, nice.
It works fantastic. They got A+.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some other cool projects floating around. Some people at Erlang Solutions have put out a version of Erlang for the Raspberry Pi and been doing some cool embedded stuff.
Yeah, we work with the BeagleBoards.
Yeah, similar. You know, somebody asked Joe Armstrong if you could run Erlang on a cell phone.
Yes, you can.
And of course, yeah, of course. And, you know, he rightfully pointed out that the smartphones of today are hugely more powerful than the, you know, high-end workstations that they developed Erlang on in the first place. You know, in 1987, they were using, you know, probably a HP or a Sun or whatever workstation that, you know, had a 68020 processor in it or whatever, or maybe a Spark, you know, running at 20 megahertz, you know. Nowadays, you've got a four-core thing, and, you know, if you've got a high-end cell phone, it's got four cores running at, a, you know, 800 megahertz or something and 2 gigs of RAM or whatever it is.
Yeah, quite powerful. Yeah.
You get spoiled. I mean, I learned to program things like an Apple II and similar vintage.
Yeah, I started with Apple II, yeah.
I started with a Radio Shack color computer, which was sort of similar. You know, it just had, you know, 16 kilobytes of RAM. Between the computers on my desk, I have got over 20 gigabytes of RAM now, spread over several computers, but still.
Yeah.
So it's insane how much, you know, it's grown.
Yeah. And also the CPM operating system at the time, yeah.
Yeah,
engines.
Yeah, well, you know, it's on the other hand, some of the, you know, stuff that was developed back in those days is still pretty interesting. I mean, Lisp dates from the late 50s, and it's still brilliant.
Actually, it was the second programming language.
Yeah, the second Fortran.
Yeah, Fortran was the first.
And Fortran's still getting used for stuff. You know, if you want serious number.
It's not the same Fortran, though.
It's not the same Lisp either, but it's...
Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty amazing. You know, just the level of what we've accomplished and then how much stays the same.
Yeah. Actually, most of the theory for concurrent programming was invented in the 70s, early 80s.
I believe it.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny when people talk about, you know, Scala or whatever having Lisp or not Lisp, like Erlang-like characteristics.
Yes.
You know, what they mean is it's, you know, it's got messages and independent, you know, things like that, but they miss the exit characteristics, the whole ability to... you know, the signals and the monitors and things like that.
Yes, they lack the signaling.
Yeah.
Which the process fails, yes.
The process failure mechanism, which is, I think, the magic that is Erlang. So what features of Erlang have your students, you know, found the most interesting and the most difficult?
I think it's the functional programming is very new to them because it's the first time they encounter functional programming in practice. They didn't even learn the theory, so no loops, no branching, all recursion.
Yeah.
This is the first concept. After they get over it, it takes them like it breaks all the habits. The second one, I think, it's like only one-time variables in Erlang, assigned once.
Yeah, assigned once and then one and done.
Yes, so after this, they have to change everything like the concepts. And actually, they find that it helps them a lot in other languages, other concepts.
Yeah, I found that a lot when you start doing functional programming. When I first learned Scheme, which is, you know, of course, a Lisp family, suddenly I took everything I knew and was writing better code in other languages.
Yeah, of course.
What do you use a book or a textbook to teach them?
Yes, I use. I think everything on the market I have already. So I started with Joe's book, the first one, and I have the book of Simon, and I book the Flogan, and let's say Erlang and OTP in action.
All right. I think we've had all the authors of those books on the podcast, and several of them. Simon St. Lawrence is a regular. Have you used Fred's book, Learn You Some Erlang?
Yes, I use it. Yeah.
Yeah, Fred's also a regular. Great guy. One of them. I haven't actually met him in person yet.
I send them to his website.
Yeah.
I have the book, but I send them to
his website. I actually don't have a physical copy yet. I just go to his website.
Yeah, electronic copy. Yeah.
You know, he gives it away for free. So.
Yeah, on the web. Yes. So they found that, like, for initial stages, it's a very good site. For everybody that wants to start Erlang, it's a fantastic site.
Yeah. So I'm working on a new book called Testing Erlang.
Oh, very good.
You can actually, I'll put the link up. It's on GitHub. I mean, all like just the sources of the book. I'm just writing it on GitHub. So anybody wants to read it, give comments, open issues, send me a pull request. Feel free.
Oh, yeah, I would love to.
Translate it into Hebrew.
If you are going to, let's say, embrace the concept of write program with testing in mind.
Yeah, I've actually spent the last day or two trying to get my head around property-based testing.
Oriented programming, yeah.
What?
Testing-oriented programming.
Yeah. Right, but I mean, so in addition to just standard unit tests, you also have the quick check type property tests where you have, you know, where basically you can express a property of the code.
Yeah.
So, for example, for like some of the new data structures in React, where you have data structures where the operations are commutative, you know, basically you can create a vector of operations, apply it, shuffle it into a different order, apply it again, you should get the same results. Create 1,000 random vectors, do that over and over again, and, you know, make sure it works for all 1,000 cases. So it's, you know, it's a pretty powerful mechanism, but it does take a little, it's got a learning curve, which I'm still trying to fight my way through.
Yeah. Commutativity, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's one example. I haven't hit that, but just, you know, where you can just sort of say, okay, you know, here's the properties I want of my data structure and its accessor functions. You know, here's a description of them. Generate 10,000 random cases and make sure they all work.
Yeah.
It's easy to say, you know, all right, here's, you know, a very simple example, but how do you, but, you know, setting that up so it all works is a little more difficult. And unfortunately, neither of the two libraries, either Proper or QuickCheck, their online documentation isn't so great.
Maybe Common Test?
Well, it's Common Test. Common Test, yeah, it's a different thing. I mean, that's also going to be in there. You guys use Dialyzer at all?
No, I have no time. It's only one course. It's very dense.
Yeah. Dialyzer is great because you don't have to do anything. You just run it. It takes 5 minutes to set up, and it catches all sorts of bugs. It's great.
Yeah, I know. It speeds up everything. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't write code without it. We actually had Costas on for episode 16, which unfortunately has lousy audio. So if you want to go listen to it, you should be warned. The audio quality is kind of iffy. And actually, the truth is, I spent my time banging my head against Dialyzer for a while until I went to the Erlang User Conference last year and sat down with Costas, and he showed, you know, got him to teach me how to use it.
Yeah, I was exposed to it. In October, I was in Erlang camp in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, Brian Hunter, who was one of the organizers of that, is another one of our regulars here. But since we're recording this December 26th, pretty much everybody else is off having, you know, doing Christmassy stuff with their families.
Yeah, sure.
Hence the All Israeli podcast. I actually was trying, the other option was try to get this guy, Jordan, one of the Basho guys. All right, quick, find all the Jews.
I forget Jesus was a Jew.
But he probably didn't know anything about Erlang.
Yeah.
I got to come down there and just meet your crew. Because, I mean, if nothing else, I would like just have more Erlang programmers in Israel. Because one of the problems we have is if you try to propose to a company here, you guys should use Erlang. They're like, well, nobody knows it. Well, if you're, you know, but if you're teaching it at Ben Gurion, and I think some folks are doing some work with it up at the Technion.
Yes, I know. There is another course in the Technion teaching this. Yes, and this year I increase the population because I will teach it already also to computer engineering students.
So how many students do you have total in this class?
It will be two classes. I think it will be something about 35 or 40 students.
Total?
Yeah, in total.
Maybe I can go twist some arms at the university here in REL and see if they teach a class or if they'd be interested in doing a class. Unfortunately, my Hebrew isn't up to actually trying to teach it, do it might help them out in that sense, but maybe I can just convince them that it's a good idea or at least go give them a talk on it or something.
Yeah, actually, they love it. After they're exposed and they see what they can do in 2 weeks of project, everybody is amazed.
Now
it became very popular in my department.
It is a very productive language.
Yes. Actually, it's not a library. All the properties are embedded in the language itself. So
it's all embedded in the language. It's all, well, I mean, some of it is library. I mean, some of the OTP is partially library, but, you know.
Yes.
The line between what is library and what is language is certainly one that's gotten vague over the years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. you know, how do you, you know, what do you call a library? What do you call the language? Yeah, I've been working in sort of, you know, figuring out all sorts of testing mechanisms and how do you test software quality. That's been a big interest of mine recently.
Yeah.
So
I was looking for somebody that would be interested in robotics with Erlang.
It's been done. There was actually a video posted. They fitted a little toy helicopter with, you know, had a processor. They fitted it with a controller running Erlang, introduced a bug so that one of the four rotors didn't work right, and they were flying it around the room, and in the middle of flying it, they did a hot swap on the code.
Yeah.
It was really awesome. Right? It started out sort of being wobbly and not flying very well. They hit a button, and it's like, poof, straighten out and fly right, and it did.
Yeah.
You know.
But what I was thinking is more like taking advantage of the communication and work on a swarm of robots, small robots.
Yeah, it's so, you could use something like a RIAC core to coordinate between them.
Yeah.
And then just, you know, RIAC, are you familiar with RIAC core?
I know what RIAC core is, but I didn't use it.
Okay. So just
Three of RAM showed it to me once.
Yeah, it's a basically distribution mechanism. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
We used it for a caching system where you basically the distribution, just all the distribution failover, you know, resuming, all that stuff just sort of becomes trivial. They solve all the problems for you. It's really nice. Well, I wouldn't say all the problems, but a lot of them. We're going to have them on the show at some point after the new year. Oh, so anything else from your experience teaching Erlang?
I have lots of anecdotes.
Oh, okay. So let's hear some of them.
Like comments from students.
Yeah.
It would be interesting. So, what happens that in parallel to my course, they learn information theory.
Okay.
And the lecturer of information theory wanted them to simulate in Mathematica. You know Mathematica,
it's been
environment?
Last time I used it was sometime in the early 90s when I was in university, but I certainly know what it is.
Yeah, so what happens that all the guys that took the Erlang course in parallel became much better Mathematica programmers because they knew how to control the patterns and how to control the functional programming, so they became very efficient. And it was a side effect that I didn't predict.
Well, that's not so good. You know, Erlang is a functional language where we try to control side effects. So, you know, we like to build a reason about our side effects, but I guess that only applies to the code, not the programmers.
So that became very, very good. What I heard from some other students that, you know, they were interviewed for work after they graduated. So somebody asked a guy, okay, for our next meeting, you should give me some programs that will do like a web server. Use any language you like. So he brought him back two lines of code written in Erlang. And it could pass JSON and everything already in two lines.
You know, I've never actually had that happen to me from the other side of the desk, but I can imagine it where you're just like, oh, well, yeah,
I can do that. Your expertise, you can say, I can do that.
I had a client once who, you know, he asked me to write some code for them when I was a consultant. And so I wrote the code and I sent it to them and they look at it and they're like, you know, it's like 50 lines of code or whatever. And they're like, that can't possibly do what we asked him to do. And then they ran it and it did. And they're like, oh, I guess it can.
Oh.
He ended up hiring me as a full-time employee later. You know, the client, when he went to found a startup, ended up bringing me on as a co-founder. So, you know, I guess it worked out okay.
So, yeah, you know, all the concept, if you have to design finite state machines inside Erlang to implement protocols and behavior like of servers and log servers and event servers. So it helps them a lot. So
yeah, it's
actually when they are asked to program something in an interview, so they prefer to do it in Erlang because it's easier to sing.
you know, funny.
Yeah, it's not. You know, I don't think so, but they found it. So you know, you cannot predict every effect or side effect. Yeah, it's a functional programming with side effects, non-programmed effects.
I remember a comment by, I think it was Simon Payton Jones, talking about the early days of Haskell where they didn't have a way to do side effects at all. It's like, yeah, your program would just run and run and run. The only side effect would be the processor gets hot.
Yeah.
Which is a side effect, although not a particularly useful one. So yeah, you said we should, I like your idea that we should do an Erlang camp in Israel.
Yeah, I would love to. Maybe I can promote the hosting in Ben Gurion, web facilities.
Yeah, your university. I assume that means you have classrooms.
We have classrooms. We have yes, of course, and labs, everything.
Yeah, that's pretty much what you need. As long as they all have air conditioning.
Yeah, we have.
Because Be'er Sheva, the suburb, gets hot. Don't get me wrong. I love the Israeli desert, but it's hot.
You know, outside the building it's hot, but inside the building it's okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that'd be fun. We'll let's do that. We'll do an Erlang Camp Israel. Let us know if people are interested. We'll start putting it together. We'll try to also maybe organize it with a couple days of touring around Israel for people who want, you know, because if you're going to come all this way to Israel, if you're out from outside the country, you know, we should show you Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and the desert and Masada and other cool stuff.
We can do something like summer school for Erlang.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we have a shortage of cool things, you know, cool tech. Introduce you to some techie people around Israel. Introduce you to some of the cool sites around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Make it a working vacation for people. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
You know, because we've got everything. And the nice thing about Israel is pretty much everything's in a 3-hour drive. Nothing's far away in this country.
Yeah.
You know, you could go the entire length of the country. It's in 7 hours. 6 if you drive like an Israeli.
Yeah. Yeah. We need code swapping ourselves. Yeah. Yeah. A cool drive.
My car crashed. Oops, that supervisor will reboot it. Yes, your car does not come with a supervisor. Well, I suppose if it's a rental car, it does. Because if it gets to an accident, you call road services and they come and they bring you another one. But it does take a while.
Yeah, but it's the Erlang style of things.
Yeah, the car broke. Okay, they'll just come bring me another one.
Have another one.
So, any other student anecdotes?
Student anecdotes. Yeah, another one. I had students in one class, and he became later my master's student.
Okay.
And now he started to work one company, high-tech company in Israel. And he started to talk with people on the, you know, in charge of the software and the company. Say, but you can solve it much simpler with Erlang. I say, Erlang what? So after 3 months in the industry, he told me, I want to come to your class now and give them a talk how much it is important to take this course. Because you see how it goes in the industry. Actually, it can solve lots of issues, yeah.
If you want to do something that involves, you know, highly concurrent, highly scalable, whatever, it's kind of the best choice because, you know, that's what it was built for.
Yeah.
There's none of this process pool. You know, you want to have pump data out to 100,000 users. Well, what do? You just create 100,000 processes and you're done.
Yeah.
Each one deals with one user. You create 100,000 of the stupid things. You know, maybe spread over 3 or 4 computer servers, but yeah, whatever. You spread 100,000, create 10 million of them. You know, it scales linearly. You just add boxes.
Yeah, of course. Actually, what you can take out of one box is much larger than you can do with Java or C++.
Well, you know, it's just the fact that, you know, an Erlang process takes, you know, what is it, 500K, a kilobyte, whatever?
Yeah, somewhat.
Something like that. I've never actually measured it, but it's something pretty small. Whereas a Java process or a C# process takes, or thread, I guess they call them, but same deal.
Yeah.
Takes a megabyte. So, yeah, you have 1,000-to-1 advantage there.
Yeah, of course. You know, when I saw for the first time that they opened more than 100,000 processes on Raspberry Pi, it was amazing.
Impressive.
Actually, it was 110,000 processes.
I was speaking to a friend of mine. We were using Web Machine at my old startup to do our APIs. I love Web Machine; it's great. And I had a little program in R that measured the response times. And our key API call, the one that was sort of the most important, whatever, its mean response time was about 4.5 milliseconds.
Yeah.
And he's a Ruby guy, you know, when they're just like, yeah, we got it down to 97 milliseconds or 110 or whatever. And I'm just like, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm at 4 and I'm considering, should I optimize it more? You know, maybe I can get that to 3. You know, 4 milliseconds.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's nice when you get a web response down to 2, 3, 4, and 5 milliseconds for the simple thing that, you know, it reduces your concurrency requirements because if every response only takes 4 milliseconds, and you have, you know, under 250 responses per second, chances are you're not really being very concurrent at all. Because, you know, statistically, yeah, you know, all right, well, probably not exactly true, but on average, you probably only have one or two running at any given instant. You know, it's just, you're getting concurrency, just they're coming one right after another. Now, that being said, as you start scaling up, it'll still be pretty fast. And I suspect there were some bottlenecks in that app. Unfortunately, the company went broke before we hit them, so we never debugged them. I'm sure they were there, but the company went broke, so it didn't really matter.
Yeah, but you know, it's amazing. Actually, Erlang is not real time; it's soft real time.
Right.
But it performs very well. Yeah.
You know, but for most things, soft real time is pretty good. You know, 4 milliseconds. Yeah. You know, plus or minus a half for many things. For a vast number of applications, 4 milliseconds. Is, you know, it's good enough. You know, if you can reduce it a little bit, even better. But, and this was on an Amazon EC2 small, it wasn't on like a ginormous server, it was on a small one.
Yeah, you know, the processors of Tilera company, you know, Tilera,
I think so. Yeah,
Tilera, they sell like a system on a chip.
Yeah, yeah.
They have chips with 72 cores inside. It's on a grid, and actually Erlang works on this.
Sweet.
And I had one board for experimentation 2 years ago, and it was fantastic. You could parallel programming, not concurrent programming,
right.
Actual parallel programming using Erlang.
Well, you know, we've had several episodes about this in the past. Kevin Hammond from the Release Project came on an episode 10 or 11. He's working at University of St. Andrews, and they're talking about how do you scale Erlang up to systems like that or even bigger where you have not 70 cores, but, you know, 7,000 cores. They're doing the EU has put some real money into this. You know, the first 30 years of the desktop computing, you know, from the days of the Apple II and even earlier, you know, even back to the PDPs and stuff, you know, we were really dominated by Moore's Law, where computers just got faster, doubled the speed every 18 months or so. You know, if you were a programmer in the 90s, you wanted your program to run twice as fast, all you had to do was sit and wait for 18 months and it would magically happen.
Yeah. Under the condition you don't move to a newer Windows system.
right. But if you're on a server or something, you know. Yeah. And, you know, nowadays, our processors aren't getting faster. Clock speeds or if anything are inching down.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, we're just more interested in doing things like making them run with less electricity, which is, you know, in general, a net good thing, I suppose. But we're getting more cores, so... You know, where Moore's Law was sort of our guiding principle for the last 35 years, for the next 35 years or more, we're going to be dealing with Amdahl's Law. And how do you rethink your process so that it's not running on, I mean, the laptop I'm recording this on in my workstation both have four cores each. But, you know, Intel just released a Xeon processor that's got 12 cores, runs 2 threads each.
No, they have 48 cores.
Oh, they have 48 cores. Is that on one chip, though? Is that like several chips? Okay, whatever. But, you know, it's a large number of cores. And IBM has a power processor that I think they can put 1,000 cores or 1,024 cores in one cabinet. And, of course, if you just, you know, what's one compute? The concept of one computer is getting to be a little more vague anyway. So, you know, you could certainly put 1,000 cores in one, you know, equipment rack if you have the cash.
No, actually, there's another very cheap solution. Do you know Parallela?
Yeah. We're trying to get them on the podcast as well. I was a little unclear, though. Are those numeric coprocessors or are those like full processors that you can... Because they have a little BeagleBoard, you know, BeagleBoard type thing that's got a 16-core processor on it. And,
yeah, it's like the first generation.
And then they have a 64-core they're working on as well. They had some real... There was some real... disasters along the way, but they seem to be back on track. I'm a little unclear though. Is that machine are those 16 cores like a can you utilize them from within Erlang efficiently? Do you know?
I don't know. Erlang Solutions, you know, the embedded department.
Yeah, we're going to get them on the podcast at some point too.
Yes. So they declared that they are very interested in it, but at the moment it looks like more like a GPU, sophisticated GPU.
Right. I mean, the thing is, you can get a sophisticated GPU. It's called a video card. You know,
yeah.
You can get pretty sophisticated GPUs already. You know, for people who are into gaming or math co-processing or mining bitcoins or something.
So you can program Parallela only with OpenCL at the moment.
Okay, so that's more of a GPU thing. Yeah, that seems a little less interesting, unless maybe I'm missing something, because, like I said, I can buy a video card with lots and lots of GPU cores in it, you know, limited only by money and heat dissipation.
Yeah, but it differs because in parallelas they work about with 5 or 6 watts. If you want a GPU, it's a good GPU. It's 300 watts.
Yeah,
there's a difference.
I don't know. I'm using both of my computers are using on the motherboard videos, so I don't do games, so or anything else that's particularly numerically intensive. So
actually, we did some projects on parallel programming in the university. Speed scientific computation, like electromagnetic waves inside the room for channel modeling, and okay. we got amazing results.
I believe it.
Yeah, it was a speed up of several hundreds at least.
Oh yeah, I mean the GPUs you can get in a video card now are great if you're trying to do number crunching. You can effectively build. I've not paid attention to it, but if you want to do numeric computing. For weather data or whatever, one of the 1,000 things you can do in my computing. Yeah. You go buy a $300 video card, stick it in your computer and program it, and you've got something that's a fairly good approximation of a supercomputer.
Yeah, for sure.
And you can, use Crossfire and all the tricks. You can gang up 3 or 4 of them on your motherboard and have a hell of a lot of computing power. But that's sort of a, single instruction stream just running over a lot of data.
Yeah, it's a SIMD model, yes.
Yeah, whereas what I'm interested in making dialyzer and things like that run fast where you can, have fully concurrent over multiple cores processes. I'm looking at some point to upgrade my computer, so won't be near future, but probably at some point get an one of the six-core i7 machines or something just to make Erlang run faster on my desktop.
Yeah, i7 by itself, it's very good because you have 8 hyperthreads.
Or 12, depending on which model you get.
Yeah.
And then, so what else have your students said?
So most of this, they were looking for companies that were working with Erlang because they liked the language a lot. They want to make a career out of it. But at the moment, the local market is not prepared for the language.
There are a couple.
So several people worked with Zvi Avraham.
Yep.
One guy started to work with Clojure because of his Erlang experience.
Right. Maybe we should do an Erlang jobs fair at some point in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, actually, when you see, on Google Trends to see how much an Erlang programmer can make money, salary are much better than Java programmers in Europe.
I saw an ad go by for a job in New York. Salary went to $190,000 a year. Of course, that does involve living in New York City, which is a pretty expensive place. But
yeah,
still, that was like, darn.
Yeah, you can move there.
No, I really don't want to. I like where I live.
For 2 years.
No, thank you. It's like, I like where I live.
Yeah.
I like having the fact that my son goes to a school that preschool that treats him for his autism, and it's a 3-minute walk from my front door. Can't get that in New York.
Yeah, I'm sure. In this summer, I will have much more anecdotes because what I plan to do in this course, it's like distributed video processing. We bought also cameras, small cameras for the pickleboards, and we know how to operate them. And actually, they will do something like surveillance or something in security applications, all in Erlang.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, should be.
I spoke to one of the prior episodes, I don't remember which one, some folks, they were doing image processing in Erlang. And people say, you shouldn't use Erlang for image processing. It's kind of slow. But the truth is, it actually works really well as long as you avoid NIFs, in that any given process will be slow-ish compared to in some other languages. But you can just run them, a lot of them. The concurrency thing works in your favor. So they were basically able to, analyze every image coming off Twitter on a single rack of computers that, cost $80,000 or something. But, $80,000 or $100,000 worth of equipment, with 80 to 100 grand worth of equipment, you're able to, using Erlang and RIAC Core, keep up with the complete volume of images coming off of Twitter in something close to real time.
Yeah.
So that's pretty impressive if you could just divide your job up right, you can get those effects. That's just like, holy cow.
Yeah, it's very easy to write. I don't know if image processing it's like the killing application for Erlang, but actually, you can see there is a project like a competing Hadoop. It was written in by Nokia.
Okay.
It's called Disco. You know Disco?
No. Put a link. So put a link in, like, the chat, and I'll put it in the show notes. I'll take a look. I'll put it in the show notes for people.
Yeah, it's cool. I don't know the. You have to write disco. Yeah, as you hear it, like right. Disco. And it's actually Erlang based. All the platform is based on Erlang. All the communication, the distribution, the message passing is based on Erlang. And for the, let's say, the algorithms are written in Python.
Okay.
Python over Erlang.
Anyone from that project is listening and would like to, you know, come on and talk about the project, please give me a, drop me a line. Yeah, lots of other projects are using Erlang in behind the scenes or not, you know, quietly or not, sometimes very publicly. Yeah, this is interesting stuff. Yeah, we need to figure out a way to get the profile of Erlang raised in the, you know, Israeli high-tech infrastructure, you know, scene. Because while there are a couple companies using it, Uvu uses it, Tzvi's work uses it, there are a bunch of others. You know, it's not, when you go talk to startups in Tel Aviv, they seem to all be using C#, Java, PHP, and sometimes Ruby.
Yeah, everybody that uses PHP deserves it. It's like a punishment.
What's the punishment for using PHP? PHP. Like the old joke. What's the punishment for bigamy? Having two mothers-in-law.
Yeah.
Truth be told, I actually like my mother-in-law very much, but
it's not two of them.
Two of them would be much.
Yeah.
It's great. They have a great advantage of having made Aliyah. Most of my family don't annoy me as much as they could. They're all back in America.
Yeah.
Amazing how it's less annoying somebody is when they're separated by 6,000 miles.
Yeah, so you love them a lot. from a distance.
Crazy relatives. Don't bother me. So, yeah, no, we need to just get Erlang. We need to get more startups using Erlang.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think the future of Internet of Things already also is a very good candidate for Erlang.
Yeah.
Because you would have tons of, you know, IP-based devices communicating one with each other. So it's a ton of information to process. And Erlang looks like, you know, very natural solution for this.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, there was a talk given at Strange Loop a couple of years ago by Professor Abelson of MIT, and he's talking about, you know, we don't know how to compute. You know, one of the points he made was, is we're coming, I think we're going to move from, in the old days, we had, you know, ginormous mainframes that were all our computing. Then we moved to desktops and laptops and stuff. And I think we're going to sort of replicate that again, where we're going to add another phase of even smaller computing devices that, with like our phone, cell phones, and even smaller, where we have, you know, you may have a desktop where you do use for your writing and for your creative work, but you have lots and lots of little things that are also have some limited computing power in them. So I think that's going to happen, and I think Erlang's a good solution for that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think your students are in good position to learn that. We just need to figure out how to get them jobs.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, and preferably jobs where they can stay in Israel, you know.
You know, my main concern is to leave them, make them stay in the south.
Even better.
Yeah.
Stay in Be'er Sheva, not just all move to Tel Aviv. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Haifa or whatever. Yeah, no, how is the high-tech scene in Be'er Sheva? There are a lot of companies?
At the moment, it's not so well. We have several companies that actually shifted to Be'er Sheva, like ECI and some other Deutsche Telekom labs. Now they are in Be'er Sheva in the high tech. But some other companies are, you know, experiencing the difficulties, you know, financial difficulties.
Right.
Yeah, it's a process. I think in 10 years it would be much better in the south because all the infrastructure is ready to, you know, to have companies.
And you now have a faster train to Tel Aviv for when you...
Yes. You know, yeah, when the shift of a large group of people, you know, from several units will go to the south, so it will help.
And if housing prices are cheaper than Tel Aviv, that will help too.
Yeah.
Because for those of you who are not familiar with Israel, Tel Aviv is cheaper than San Francisco or Manhattan, but it's still pretty expensive.
Yeah.
My wife and I actually looked at moving down there at one point, but ended up in Ariel instead. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and the thing is, having a couple of big companies is nice, but what you really want, I think, is a culture of startups where you have, you know, 50 startups running around recruiting people and doing meetups and stuff that can,
yes.
That can, you know, provide lots of jobs and quick growth opportunities, you know, interesting growth opportunities.
You know, on the previous hype at the year of 2000, a little bit earlier, there were several startups in Be'er Sheva, and actually it was very good for students.
Right, Well, I think what you need to do is convince your students to start building startups.
Yeah, M Systems, you know, they started in the South. Now they are part of SanDisk.
Okay.
Very good. And there were several startups in communication technology. You know, switches, quality of service, aware switches.
Okay.
So they start, yeah.
Stuff I know very little about, but so, yeah, okay. So you guys, do you run on a, I don't really know much about Israeli universities. Do you run on a, you know, three terms a year or two terms?
We run two semesters.
Two semesters, okay. So, yeah, I went to Brandeis and we did the same. A lot of places in the U.S. do three, so. And
they do trimesters, short ones, of 2 months each.
Brandeis didn't, but I know a lot of universities do. So it just depends. Yeah. Yeah, I will admit my main experience with Be'er Sheva has been it's generally just the place I stop to get dinner, as I'm heading down to the desert for some astronomy.
Yeah, or to Eilat.
I've actually been to Eilat. I usually go to Mitzpe Ramon, which for those outside of Israel is a small town in the middle of the Negev Desert, which truly gorgeous scenery if you like the desert. But it's also got pretty much the darkest skies you'll find in Israel. So if you're interested in astronomy, it's a great place to go. Because really dark skies, only 2.5-3 hours from Tel Aviv. You know, nice combination. And Be'er Sheva is about an hour north of there. And it's, you know, a good place to stop and make sure you have, you know, grab some food and some supply, you know, some munchies and stuff. Especially since there's a couple of good shawarma joints right at the entrance to town that, you know, make for a good dinner.
Yeah.
We need to figure out how to get, you know, more Erlang jobs in Israel.
I think so. Maybe more Erlang education. So, if lots of people are, you know, are coming from the, you know, from the university system, out of the university system, and they want to use some language, it will create a pressure.
Right. Okay, well, we'll have to figure that out. It's an ongoing thing. Do you know of any of the other there's what, 8 universities in Israel now? So
yes, including Ariel.
What? Including Ariel.
Including Ariel, yes.
So, yeah, Ariel, where I live, we had a college that just got promoted to university with some great deal of controversy because we're over the green line. And there was serious brouhaha, but the truth is, from what I know, it's a pretty good school. And several of my friends actually teach there, although none in computer science, one in biology and one in physics. So
you're in a good company, so you can teach there.
Yeah, like I said, my Hebrew isn't really up to it; it's pretty useless. So
you can teach a graduate course, so you can so you can start with English.
So I teach a graduate course, yeah, which is kind of funny because I only have a bachelor's degree and it's not even in computer science.
Yeah, but you are some sort of an expert, so it's an expert course.
Okay, yeah. I've been building web stuff for 20 years. You know, my first web app was built with Perl version 4 and MSQL because MySQL didn't exist yet. Well, you know, obviously it wasn't, the reason I chose MSQL wasn't, well, gee, there's another project I'd like to use, but it hasn't been invented yet. You know, it's just MSQL was what was available at the time. This was 1993, 1994. Never got adopted. It was doing phone support at this internet service provider outside of Boston and long since gone out of business. But they had no system to track who had called in and talked to what customer service rep. So people would call 5 or 6 times, get 5 or 6 different people. And we'd have no clue who they'd spoken to before, if they'd spoken to before, what they'd been told, nothing. So I tried to write an app, a web app, to, you know, solve this problem. I mean, it was, by comparison to something we'd write today, unbelievably primitive. But, you know, for 1994, it was pretty good. It was pretty sophisticated.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a hell of a lot better than what they had prior, which was to say nothing.
Yeah. Everything is better than nothing, yeah.
Pretty much. So, have any of your students, you know, put a web interface in any of their projects? You know, HTTP?
No. We don't get to this.
All right. So
it's like, if you look at the courses of Erlang solutions, you know, they teach Erlang.
Yeah.
So, it's more than what they teach in the first course, you know, basic Erlang.
Right.
But not much more.
Okay.
I get to ETS and that's...
About where you stop.
Yes, I stop at ETS and that's... This is like the final point for the course.
Okay. Well, like I said, once, you know, next semester that you teach it, give me a shout and I'll come on down.
Yeah, for sure.
The
Maybe I will join the two courses for a guest lecture once.
That'd be fun. Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah.
And as I recall, the train station in Beersheba is right by the university anyway.
Yeah, of course.
So it's an easy train ride.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we'll come down. We'll talk. It'll be fun. We'll maybe we can even do an Erlang hackathon. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
Pick a day, as long as it's not on Shabbos, the middle of the week, where just, you know, sit and write code for 12, you know, pull out laptops, write code for 12 hours.
Right? Yeah, I would like to do something like what Brian did in Nashville. They got Nash FP, right. Nash Functional Programming, like to open a group.
Well, there's a group in Tel Aviv, Sayaret Lambda. Yardana Merriman runs it. Maybe you can talk her into having an occasional meeting in Beersheba.
Yeah, we can host them for sure.
And, you know, if you do want to have a Beersheba FP, and I think you should, as long as you can, I'd love to come and give a talk, you know, give a lecture. I may have to figure out some logistics because, you know, if it's getting done at 10 at night, I'm not sure I want to drive home. It's a bit late to be starting a two-hour drive. But
yeah,
I'm sure somebody can find me somewhere to crash, so that's not a big deal.
Yeah, you can stay at my place.
Oh, that works, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm easy. But yeah, I think getting more Erlang culture up and running around various parts of Israel, and I think also the moving, you know, there's been a lot of agenda in Israel about moving stuff to the periphery, again, for folks outside of Israel. High tech is incredibly concentrated in the greater Tel Aviv area, and there's a little bit in Haifa, in Jerusalem, and Beersheba, and probably other places, but it's like 80% of the startups are in the greater Tel Aviv area. Which, of course, pushes people to Tel Aviv, which pushes prices on real estate up, because while their jobs move to Tel Aviv, you know, if your job moves to Tel Aviv or you want to get a job in Tel Aviv, you need to live somewhere where it's a reasonable commute. And Israel's, you know, that pushes, of course, pushes up real estate prices. And
yeah,
it's a vicious cycle. So having, you know, moving stuff out to places like Ariel, to Beersheba, to up to the north is nice, because then people can, you know, work in a high-tech company doing fun stuff. And not have to commute into, not have to deal with Tel Aviv real estate or Tel Aviv traffic. I don't know what houses cost in Beersheba, but I suspect they're a lot cheaper than Tel Aviv.
You know, I now recall another nice anecdote.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, for the first time that I gave the course, you know, it was very new. So every two lectures, I passed a questionnaire to the students, what they like, what they don't like, you know, just to construct the course.
Yeah.
You know, it would be nice for them. And one student, it was like an amazing programmer. He was very good in software. He said, I don't believe in Erlang. I said, why not? Yeah. He said, you know, I have one criteria to judge a new language, which Erlang was not new.
Yeah. New to him, at least.
Yeah. I count the number of books on the language. And I found only two books. It was one book of Joe and the other one
Francesco.
Of Simon.
Simon and Francesco's book, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're now up to about 10, and that's only including the ones written in English, because there's Joe's book. There's Simon and Francesco's book. There's Simon St. Lawrence's Introducing Erlang. There's my book, Building Web Applications with Erlang. There's the Manning book. There's Fred's book. There's Neuroevolution Through Erlang, which I haven't bought because it's like $150 and I'm not that.
Yeah, it's very expensive. Yeah.
There's my Testing Erlang, which is in development. Still working on that. 7 Languages in 7 Weeks has a section on Erlang.
Yeah, of course.
Bruce Tate, by the way, the author of that book, will be joining us in February. So come back for that. And I think there are a couple more I'm forgetting. Pavlo Baron wrote a book on Erlang, but it's in German. So if you are interested in reading a book in German, go for it.
Yeah.
And I think I'm forgetting one or two, but there are a couple of others that are either in the works or have come out. So, you know, it is a valid concern because, you know, there was a long time where Erlang was theoretically open source, but if you didn't work for Erlang Solutions or Ericsson, you know, you had no way of learning it.
Yeah. For sure. You know, just to decide on the programs that I will use in my course, it took me more than a year.
Right.
You know, I looked everything, and for the first time I thought I would teach both Erlang and Clojure, but then I decided to stay only on Erlang because it was much easier.
Right. I mean, the truth is, Fred, if I had to pick just one of those to tell somebody to learn Erlang from, It would be Fred's book, Learn You Some Erlang.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, the advantage that you can read it. You know, you can buy the book from No Starch Press, and I recommend that if you want to. But you can also read it for free. Also, Francesco Simon and Robert Verding are coming out with a new book from O'Reilly all about OTP in great detail. So that should be out.
Oh, yeah. That's very good.
Next summer. And I think there's also a book coming out on the details of the Erlang virtual machine. I'm not sure when that'll be out, but it's in the works from O'Reilly. And there's probably a couple others that are in the process. That being said, I'm sure there is need for more of them, for more books on Erlang. We could use one on Amnesia. We could use one on RAC Core. We could use one on built, you know, a more advanced web building, you know, web framework using Chicago Boss kind of book. Some of these are probably being talked about with editors somewhere, but they've not raised the level of my awareness yet. So. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I will talk to you in the summer.
Yeah, we're probably gonna. I know Simon Thompson at University of Kent is gonna be teaching Erlang to his students. Yeah. So we're gonna have a future episode on this sort of similar topic and teaching students Erlang. So when that happens, I'll give you a call back and we'll get you on it, because you know this is more. This has sort of been a sort of some of teaching students, but also some of how to promote Erlang in Israel and a few other random things. Cool. So I think we're gonna call it a night here. And this will probably get, I'm going to edit this probably on Sunday, and it'll probably go up right after New Year's, right after the first of January. Good. Just realizing that releasing it in that week between Christmas and New Year's is going to, you know, really kill the downloads for it. So, all right. So just a couple of announcements before we close out the episode. So first of all, some upcoming events. Erlang Factory San Francisco Bay will be from March 3rd to 12th. Of March in San Francisco, and I think there's some discounts, and the conference looks really great. Lambda Days will be in February 27th, 28th of February in Krakow. It's got some great people, Kevin Hammond, Jose Valim, who created Elixir, Torben Hoffman will be speaking, as well a bunch of others. NDC Oslo will be on the 2nd to the 6th of June in Oslo. Speakers include Douglas Crockford, Scott Hanselman, others. Brian Hunter's been trying to get a lot of people to submit functional programming talks to that event. Unfortunately, I can't make it. But if you can make it to Oslo for that, and you'd like to submit a talk on functional programming, especially Erlang, that'd be great. We're trying to reach out to communities. There's some other events coming up. Those are the only ones I have sort of top of my head. Other thing is Tiffany Simpkins Russell, who was a guest of ours on one of the early episodes on diversity and community. She just released an app called A Song for Miles. So we'll put a link to that. But if you're going to go check that out, it's for the iPhone and the iPad. Unfortunately, I have an Android, so I won't be downloading it myself, but that's okay. Anyway, that's it. Once again, as always, if you're doing cool stuff around Erlang, and I include Elixir and other languages that run on the Beam, in that you've got a cool project, or you're teaching it, or you're doing research on it, please drop me a line, and we will. You'd like to come on the show, we will get you on the show, and talk about what you're doing and why it's cool. You know, the job of the role of this podcast is to promote projects around Erlang, and so that's what I'm thinking. All right, Yehuda, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
If I thought of this in advance, I would have asked you to bring one of your students with, a couple of your students, former students with you, but I only had the idea for this episode yesterday, so it didn't happen. All right, cool. Thanks. And okay. We'll see you next in January. We've got a full suite of shows coming up. The schedule, as it stands right now for the upcoming shows, let me just give you an idea of what's coming up. This is subject to change. We're going to talk about bottlenecks. Costas Sagonis will be coming back to talk about proper and property-based testing. We'll be talking about new to Erlang. So if you're interested in learning Erlang or you are learning Erlang, we have that. Capacity planning. At the end of January, we're joining with five other podcasts, including Ruby Rogues, Giant Robots Smashing Into Other Giant Robots, Node Up, the change log, herding code, about teaching kids programming. On the 29th, we're having the Industrial Erlang User Group. And then Bruce Tate, author of Seven Languages in 7 Weeks and other books, will be joining us in February. We don't have anything scheduled past that, but if you'd like to come on the show and do something interesting, drop me a line. And if you have ideas for things that we should cover, even if you don't want to be on it yourself, you can reach me on Twitter, either at Mostly Erlang or at Zeke Hessen, and I'll try to get it on. All right. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.